You're listening to The Daily Digestionalist with Matthew Heidmark at RadioArian.com.
Welcome to the Daily Traditionalist. Today's date is the 4th of April 2017, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. I'm standing in for Matthew Heimbach once again, and I have with me today one of our regular co-hosts, and certainly a good friend to Matt, and certainly one of my favourite co-hosts to actually talk with on the Daily Traditionalist. We have Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson with us today. Matt, how are you doing today?
Excellent. Yes, the feeling is mutual.
Good. It's a beautiful day here in Britain. I hope it's a good day over there. The last time we were talking together, we were advertising a protest that took place last Friday in London, and that went off very well. So I hear Richard Edmonds has written a report on that. There's also video of the speeches there. There was Jez Turner was speaking there, Richard Edmonds was speaking there, and Paul Pitt as well. And you can find that on the Radio Arian site on the front page there. It's actually taken from the National Front site. But apparently it's a really, really good protest. There wasn't any trouble there. Also, over the weekend, I went to the Yorkshire Forum, and that was a really, really good conference, nationalist conference, and fantastic speeches there. And again, we've got that over at the Radio Arian site. So we've got some good news there to start off with, some good movement news, because the rest of what's going on at the moment, it's not too cheerful. Is it really, Matt? Obviously, we're going to have to talk about geopolitical news in this podcast, since we have you here with us. And I guess the first thing we should talk about is this this attack in Russia. I'd really like to get your thoughts on that, mainly because I know that you can read the Russian language. So you'll be able to see what the media is saying about this that is being hidden from us over here in the Western world. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, at the moment, there's really been no in-depth analysis in either language. This is still a new event. The DNA evidence seems to point to Dzhalov, the 22-year-old from Kyrgyzstan, to do this. But you know, the actual person isn't important. It's really the reason for it. I think that the gas attack in Syria and this bombing are linked, because Assad has won the war, which means Russia has won the war, which means Russia yet again has defeated the West, has outmaneuvered the regime, and this is a form of punishment. 2017 is the year that Putin is going to bring Russian oil purchases off the dollar. He's going to do this with China and India through the agency of the SCO and, of course, the BRICS later on. So this is a form of panic. This terror attack in St. Petersburg is just a warning. The gas attack in Syria is more serious, but they're linked in that respect. This is pure regime. These things don't just happen. And Petersburg being the capital of the old Russian Empire, that is to say from Peter the Great to the Bolsheviks, is significant as well. But they are definitely linked, and it's a way to punish Russia for the humiliation of the West. Again.
So the Syrian gas attack and the Russian attack, they're linked, rather than the Russian bombing being linked to the Islamic attack in London last week. That makes sense. I hadn't actually thought of that myself. This Syria chemical attack, that's recent news, that's just coming out now. When I first heard that, I thought, I wonder if that's Israel. Because Russia have said that their jets were grounded. Syria have said that they weren't flying, it wasn't them. And yet, clearly, there were some aeroplanes that flew overhead and dropped these bombs. And I really wouldn't put it past Israel to be doing that with flying Russian colours on their jets while they're doing this. In fact, I think I remember a news story about this a while back, about planes being painted in the colours of Russia. And another thing that it's made me think of is every time we see an atrocity, like when we saw the London atrocity last week, they switched the lights off on the Eiffel Tower, and they light up landmarks in red, white and blue. And yet this attack on Russia, there's been no solidarity from these other countries that are being attacked by Islamists. There's been no solidarity whatsoever, which would fit in if this was indeed retribution for Russia liberating Syria. Now, it's obviously some kind of blowback. Whether it's, and I guess it is quite feasible that the intelligence agencies could have encouraged these Islamic groups to go over there and do that in Russia. And on top of that, you've got the hatred that a certain portion of the Muslim world now has for Russia for liberating Syria. If you look at the Facebook page and the Al Jazeera's Facebook page, apparently there's lots of people cheering, lots of Muslims cheering this attack that took place in Russia. And we've even had the mainstream media questioning whether the attack in Russia was some kind of false flag, as if Putin and Russia were doing this to themselves to give Putin an excuse to clamp down on dissidents, because they recently had a protest against corruption, and this protest was an illegal protest. They didn't have a license for it whatsoever, so of course people were being arrested. But the mainstream media has been honing in on this protest as if there's a big problem with corruption in Russia, and the people are all out protesting against it. Never mind the fact that Putin has an approval rating of 80 or 90%, and the person that was organizing these corruption protests is funded by America and the NGOs. So the mainstream media was trying to concentrate on that and trying to push this narrative that this was a false flag. And it's very rare that you actually see the mainstream media trying to push a conspiracy theory, trying to say that it's a false flag event, this attack over there on the metro. And it's dreadful. I've seen some of the film of it, some of the footage, and you can hear these children screaming. It just makes me so mad to think that these people can just come into our countries and do this. They do these sick, twisted, vicious acts against the people that have welcomed them in. And you say that this was someone from Kyrgyzstan, Matt. Is Kyrgyzstan, was that a part of the former Soviet Union? Is that a part of the Russian Federation? Or was this a migrant, as it were?
Well, yeah, it used to be a part of the Soviet Union. They used the Russian alphabet, but had their own native language, mostly Islamic. The government is generally very pro-Russian. The CIA, they have the CIA is all over the country, as they are everywhere. But the way you stated it before, linking this all together was absolutely perfect. John McCain is now on TV saying that he wants war with Syria, wants to, you know, triple, quadruple the boots on the ground to fight Assad. The one thing we have going for us is that the arguments these guys are using, the stories that they're using, and yes, by the way, it's the only two times they've ever mentioned false flag in the major press has been concerning Russia, Beslan, and now this attack. And all of a sudden they start using our language, showing that they're just thrashing around for distractions. These arguments are so bad, so obvious. I'm almost thinking that they're deliberately obvious. Why would Assad, having won the war in Syria, do something that he would know would lead to the illegitimacy of his victory? Whatever respect in the West that he would have would be destroyed by this knowledge. Why in the hell would he do that? It's a ridiculous notion. And it's so bad, such a bad argument that I think it's deliberately bad. It's Johnson's law, where people don't really know, and so they can say whatever they want, and it's believed. But Russia's more serious than Serbia, than Syria, though, because of the dollar issue this year. And so I wouldn't be surprised if there aren't more attacks as the year goes on.
Well, I'm sure there'll be more attacks. I think we have to draw a dividing line between the attacks against Russia and the attacks that we see in Western Europe, the Islamic attacks that we see in Western Europe. It seems to be two different groups almost. It's these lone wolf jihadis that are blowing themselves up in Europe, and the ones that are going into Russia are being funded by the Americans, first off for the war in Chechnya, then the war in Libya, then the war in Syria, I would guess. And I find it interesting that all these statistics and the eyewitness reports of this gas attack are coming from the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is based in Kent in the south of England. So I don't know how they're observing it. They got some extra large spy glasses or something that they can see all the way over into Syria. They know better than the Syrian government itself, which is based right outside or within a few hundred miles of Idlib province, which is where this attack took place. They're not giving any credence to what the actual Syrian government are saying about this attack. They're just paying attention to this Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is just one man operating out of a bedsit in Kent. Tragic. Tragic, really, fall for
it. With BBC money and with British Petroleum money, like all the, you know, an NGO in world politics is a spokesman for corporate interests. You look at the donor page of any NGO that matters, you know, Amnesty International, whatever it is, and it is a list of the most powerful corporations in the world. That's what an NGO is. It's a way that a corporation can become politically active, so to speak. And so they're always searching for, their own particular interests. And in Russia, remember, there's really only one issue outside of the dollar issue, which, of course, is very serious. The other one is energy. So much of the American economy is based on oil. Much of what is produced that comes into America is based on oil. Most of the products that we use are based on petroleum. The whole thing, we're in a petroleum world, and Russia won't sell out its fields to ExxonMobil. It maintains a nationalized system. And for the same reason that the Schiff family was at war with the Czars for having a state-controlled currency, the regime today is at war with Syria for maintaining a state-controlled oil industry. It's the same relationship and the same reaction from the West. The West is so obsessed with and dependent on cheap oil, but the world's largest oil reserves are in Russia. And the world's largest potential reserves are in Russia too. The obsession of the oil companies to get their hands on this is overwhelming. And since they're so dominant in financing political campaigns and NGOs, of course, Shell, BP, et cetera, ExxonMobil, they all have their own NGOs operating there, the Committee for Human Rights and all this stuff. It all starts making sense. The United States government, from an economic point of view, is and the corporations that control it, are in a state of advanced panic. Russia is going to bring down the New World Order this year by pulling Russia off the dollar, and that will crash the U.S. economy because the dollar will no longer be in demand because it won't be used in China-Russia oil sales. And the same thing goes for any member of the SCO. And plus the fact that any spike in oil prices will benefit Russia at the same time as the U.S. economy is crashing. Keep in mind, it's a myth to say that the Russian economy is dependent on oil. This is not true. About 9% of its GDP comes about 7% of its GDP comes from oil. By comparison, about in Norway, it's 9%. So that's not true. It's a heavily diversified economy. It's an old myth. But still, they still have the largest reserves in the world, and the U.S. wants their hands on them. And that's what this is partially about.
But they're held in trust for the Russian people. This is what they hate, I think. They know that the oil and the gas are nationalized over there, and yet they will try and portray it as if that's Putin's company. Putin gets kickbacks from Gazprom. And they did the same with Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, when he had the Libyan Sovereign Wealth Fund, which was all the wealth of Libya from everything that was nationalized there. The oil was nationalized there. Every resource they had was pretty much nationalized. They had billions in the account, and that was just stolen in an act of robbery. They just seized all those funds and shut down the bank accounts, and nobody knows what's actually happened to that money. And they were portraying that as if it was Muammar Gaddafi's private bank account, and it wasn't. It was the Libyan sovereign wealth fund for the Libyan people. And it's the same with Russia. You've got a nationalized oil and gas industry, and the profits from that are for the Russian people. And yet, because it's not owned by these corporations, it will be portrayed in the West as if it's privately owned by the guy at the top. And yet, if Putin was this bad man that he's made out to be over here, then why would he have such a high approval rating? Do you know what the exact approval rating is, Matt? I think it's about 80%, isn't it?
After the annexation of Crimea, it went well over 80%. It hasn't come down very much. Maybe this event will bring it up a little bit, but it never has gone under 70. I guess it depends on the agency that you use. Russian, I've seen Polish, American. You know, the American ones I don't think can be trusted, but even they're high. Polish, Hungarian, you know, traditional enemies of Russia have him at you know, 85%. That's why, you know, he doesn't give a damn. But dissidents exist. Dissidents are made fun of in Russia. They're financed by the West. These are NGO candidates. They're whores. All the pro-Western political parties put together, you know, Le Bloco and Union of Right Forces and all this, they can poll maybe 8% in any election. So that they're a joke, and that's what this is. But energy, the dollar, and of course those two things are connected, is what's driving this absolute insane hatred for Russia. And more abstractly, the nationalism, the fact that Russia is building its own economy with Chinese assistance and vice versa, kicking the IMF out, kicking the U.S. out, is on a totally different economic model, is also freaking out the American ruling class. So you know, and that's why they're reduced to these desperate, ridiculous, stupid arguments and silly accusations. And it's really bad. And it's really bad. I mean, there's no evidence, there's no truth, there's not even getting common sense to this stuff. And yet they just throw the first thing out that pops into their head because they're in a state of panic, and they should be.
Well, Putin wants a multipolar world, doesn't he? He stands in the way of a supranational government and a new world order, and he speaks about that, and he seems genuine to me in wanting that, because he does go out and protect the sovereignty of Syria. He was upset that Muammar Gaddafi was taken down from Libya, and he spoke out against that. He does seem to genuinely want to see countries left alone to progress at their own pace. If you look at the organizations that he has become a part of, they, with China, as you say, and the other countries that are part of this Shanghai Cooperation Group or what have you, they're not. It's not a supranational group. Each country involved still retains its sovereignty, which is completely different to the New World Order way of doing things. And those NGOs, the non-governmental organizations that you're talking about there, Matt, I mean, they're all just agents for a foreign power. And Russia brought in a law that these non-governmental organizations had to show where their money was coming from, because if it was coming from a foreign country, then they were clearly lobbying for the interests of people in that country and not for the interests of the Russian people. Those non-governmental organizations, they seem to have the power of governments. They're like national governments. They have the power of a country in their lobbying and what they do and the way that they listen to. And people listen to these NGOs. They listen to this Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, and what they say gets put across on the media, when really it should be the people of a country that have this say. Where are the non-governmental organizations for the British people, for the white working class, for the white Americans? We don't have any. They're all for these special interest groups, and they're all just there to push forward the agenda of this new world order. I don't know if you want to continue talking about this, Matt, or whether we should move on to the other subject that we were going to talk about.
Well, I think we covered everything we needed to. It's simply a matter of common. In the Syria case, it's simply a matter of common sense. To do something like this would be ludicrous from Assad's point of view. the first time he was accused of this would be ludicrous, because he was winning the war then. But to have won the war and now he's in the process of rebuilding. There are a few rebel-held, you know, outposts that no one cares about, that now he's going to do this. An article that I read recently in the New York Times, and why I read the New York Times is beyond me, but this very same organization that you mentioned in Kent says that Assad wants to start using chemical weapons at a low level, small conflicts, so as to get people used to it, and so over time no one will notice that he's using it. That's the argument that he makes, that if he uses it in these small conflicts, a little city here, town there, skirmish there, he'll start to normalize the use of poison gas in warfare. But I'll remind the audience that the U.S. used yellow phosphorus gas to flush the Japanese out of their caves in Iwo Jima, that the Chechen rebels with American money were using poison gas against Russian forces in the 90s, and Israel used white phosphorus against the Palestinians in Gaza. And of course, we all know about the depleted uranium and everything else, and the aftermath of these weapons and the decay of the radioactive material that the U.S. has left all over the world. So this is really a joke. So we've covered everything, and that's really what sums it all up.
It is a barbaric weapon to use, absolutely barbaric to use gas. I think Hitler was gassed in the First World War, and he said, we're never going to use gas. Because of that, that really affected him. And, of course, they never did use gas in the Second World War because it was a barbaric practice.
As he lost his sight, I think, for a couple of months, and had to have been agonizing. I know the mustard gas they were using at the time was very crude, and it must have been horrible. If Hitler was gassing people, why wasn't he using gas on the Soviet infantry as they were coming into Germany? Why wasn't he using gas? And he would have been righteous to use gas in the Soviet Union because Stalin had publicly rejected the rules of war in fighting the German. So why didn't he use it? As he was desperate and the hordes just came in, why wasn't he using gas against them? He refused. And he certainly had it. And so that just shows you, you know, the mythology about Hitler. It's all the same. It's all connected. These don't make any sense. These stories assume the ignorance of the reader, and they depend on the ignorance of the reader.
They recycle them, don't they? They recycle this atrocity propaganda. You get the same stories in the First World War, same stories in the Second World War, and now we're getting the same stories now about Syria. You would think that our people would wake up to that and realise that they were being lied to. Well, at least we have the internet now, and more of us are waking up to the fact that we're being lied to. Now, I've got a story in Britain at the moment. It's one of the main stories, is about Cadbury's, which is a chocolate company. It used to be run by a Christian. It got taken over by a Jew a couple of years back, and they have a Cadbury's Easter egg hunt, which is in allied with the National Trust, which is a charity that looks after old buildings and megalithic sites and beaches. And they have this Easter egg hunt every year, and they've changed it. They've changed it to the Great British Egg Hunt. And this has caused a real hullabaloo over here in Britain at the moment. I was very pleased to see that Theresa May has spoken out against it and said, what a load of rubbish. Why aren't you calling it Easter eggs? It's Easter. It's Easter time. It's Easter eggs. It's not Great British Eggs. And I thought this was good. It's only a small step on Theresa May's part. But it is good that she's actually standing up for tradition there, and it shows that she is more aligned with Donald Trump, who spoke about how we have to keep using Merry Christmas and this Happy Holidays rubbish is nonsense and political correctness. So it's a good thing that she spoke out against that. But of course, with Easter just coming around the corner, I noticed there was a bit of a spat on Twitter. It was a pagan and a Christian. I was very saddened to see that because they're both good people and they're both fighting on the same side. They're both intelligent people. So why fight about whether Easter is pagan or whether it's Christian? It's obviously a Christian festival now. It's based on the Passover and the Pascha, and the fact that it has the name Easter is a very modern thing. It wasn't originally called Easter, and I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about that, Matt, about this pagan Christian festival. What is it? Where did it start from? And what are your views on it?
Well, generally, I don't believe pagans are on our side. for anyone to argue that Christianity is Jewish in the same sense that my neighbor, Mr. Lieberstein, is Jewish, is a moron. It can't be sustained. The entire purpose of the Jew in the Western world is to destroy Christianity, and they care about absolutely nothing else. And it's condemned viciously in the Talmud and in all Jewish writings. The term for resurrection is Pascha, as you mentioned, which is both Hebraic and Greek. Keep in mind that Christianity initially was not even in Hebrew, was not in Aramaic, but in Greek. The first New Testament was in Greek. The church fathers were in Greek. The canons were all in Greek. Nazareth in Galilee was surrounded by Greek cities. It was a Greek area. Christ obviously spoke Latin if he could speak with Pontius Pilate. This was a Greek religion at first, not a Hebraic one. These people are often so stupid they don't realize that Greece stretched far into North Africa and deep into the Middle East at the time, before the invasion of Islam. And they forget about that. Europe was much larger than it is today, through the Greek and to some extent Latin influences in North Africa and the Middle East. But there were, you know, Nazareth is surrounded by Greek cities, and that was the language of Nazareth, at least at the elite levels, was Greek. And the Galilee was completely outside of the Jerusalem Pharisaical mentality. All of early Christianity was Greek, later Latin, Augustine being the first major Latin writer. The problem there was that Latin is far less versatile than Greek. It had a lesser vocabulary than Greek for complicated ideas. So that's where Pascha comes from. I'm not really sure. One of the weakest arguments that these people have is that different, you know, pagan deities were used for the story of Christ. I've been through them all 1,000 times. They're absolutely ridiculous. Part of the problem is that there's very, very little that we know about the pagan world in Northern Europe. It was an illiterate society. We know very, very little about it. What little we know about it comes from the church. So these festivals and these names and everything else is completely speculative. There is no Ostara, which is where this Easter is allegedly supposed to come from. The best theory as to where the word Easter comes from the old German. That means dawn. Even there's no theory that it comes from the Latin in albis, which is, you know, for Passion Week, or in white, which is the origin of the term. They're far better than this Ostara that no one ever seems to mention in Northern Europe. But of course, no one could mention it in Northern Europe under the pagan times because they weren't literate. With very few exceptions. I have a paper coming out now. Paganism was not a religion. This was a cultural way of understanding the world around them. It had no doctrine. It had no creed. It had no heretics. It didn't, you know, if paganism is religion, then so is Platonism, so is Hegelianism, and so is the average football fan. That's really what it is. It would be like an anthropologist 100 years from now trying to pretend that the football hooligans were part of a religious ceremony because they had such veneration for the team. It's pretty much the same thing. I mean, they have rituals. They have even almost liturgical forms of veneration for their favorites. Rock stars do the same thing. Rock fans do the same thing. So it's really stupid. Paganism. I don't know what paganism is, and I never heard a good definition of the term. It's essentially a secular cultural anthropology, having nothing to do with religion whatsoever. And certainly in Northern Europe, when Gregory the First sent Saint Augustine into Britain, he said very explicitly that all the native customs that you see, you retain them, except for those that blatantly contradict the faith, which are very few. And there was nothing wrong with it. It was not seen as a religion. It was seen as just local custom. The concept of paganism as religion actually came from Christians who wanted to kind of organize this foreign pagan idea into some kind of theology that they could fight. But they had no conception of it. It was simply the day-to-day customs of the land, most of which was healthy and solid. paganism can't be compared to Christianity, can only be compared to any other philosophy, any other culture in the world.
Yeah, it seems to me that the pagans, once they became Christian, then they wrote down some of their beliefs, but before then they didn't really write anything down. And when the pagans became Christians, they were still the same people. Whether they were pagan British people or Christian British people, they were still British people. They had just changed their views. It wasn't like there was Christians invaded and took over the country. These Christians were British people. It wasn't British people invading Britain and taking over the British country. And when the church did start making the laws, that was when they got rid of the Jews. So once Constantine made Christianity the official religion of Rome, they made it impossible for the Jews to stay there. And there are orders from the Pope saying, don't break down the what they were called the pagan temples. Don't break down the stone circles. Don't break down the menhirs. Leave them there. And in Wales, we've got churches that are built that are part of the stone circles. St. David was born within a stone circle. What would happen was these farmers would break down the stone circles and the stones, and they'd smash the stones up to make houses out of them. The church actually preserved them and preserved the heritage of our people. I really don't like to see the pagan Christian animosity, and I think it's stirred up by our usual enemies, to be honest, because whether you're a pagan or you're a Christian, if you're white, you're white. That's your belief system. Yeah, what is essential about you is your ethnicity. Anyway, we're getting fairly near the end of the podcast here. Matt, I don't know if you've got a final word that you'd like to leave our listeners with before we finish.
No, but we covered a lot of stuff very quickly. I'm very happy about that.
Yeah, I think it's been a good podcast today. I'm sure the listeners will have enjoyed it. So thank you very much for coming on, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Doc Savage. So have a great day and hail victory.
You've been tuned into The Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Heimbach at RadioArea.com.